have so many questions. No. I'm going to limit it to one. So my question is about healing, because I know that, you know, we're in a community, we want to press for healing and all this, you know, healing of the body, of the mind, and I'm just wondering, can you comment on the tension Paul felt? Undoubtedly, he was beaten and he felt the pain of his beatings. He was not healed of all those. I mean, I don't know for sure, but it surely sounds like he wasn't. And so,
I'm sure he had some wounds on his
back. Yeah, I'm sure he was probably a little crooked. So my question is, how do we hold that intention with our robust desire for the healing of the body and the mind, and yet be okay with the tension to wait for the resurrection? Like, do you? I don't know. It's just,
I think we contend for healing until the person dies. And then if they die, we're not offended, or we don't have all the reasons why they died. The problem is people give up and say, well, what, you know, just let them die. No, we contend. I don't care if they're 93 years old. We're going to pray they die completely healed. But then we don't have to have the answer why they died. That's what a lot of believers can't bear. They have to say, if they would have, they would have been healed. If they just didn't have to do that.
Right, but to counter that, I really respect that, and I believe that, but it seems like Paul was saying the actual groaning in the body was producing something even greater in the resurrection.
But remember, I want to make this point. I said it so fast. He wasn't groaning because his body was hurting. Like I made the joke, I go, oh, I actually really did throw a ball yesterday, and I woke up and went, oh. It's not the groan because my body's hurting. He's groaning to be further close. He's groaning for the fullness of the promise, not because of the difficulty of the day.
He's groaning and yearning, not groaning in pain.
Yeah. I mean, he could have had pain, but that's not what he's talking about. He wasn't talking about a low view of the body right now. He was talking about a high view of the resurrection. Does that make a difference, sense?
It does, but I'm still not convinced, because the actual groaning in the pain of his tent, which is wasting away, he said...
That was because of persecution, though. Just so we know, it's wasting
right,
away.
But
everybody's tent is wasting away.
Let me just make my point, and then you can crush it. The point is, the actual hope of a freedom in the future with no pain can only be understood in its fullness with pain in the body, apparently.
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that.
Seemingly, I mean, I'm just saying, because
that's not the point Paul was making. I could be misunderstanding
it.
Because remember, he said this little phrase that's so easy to miss. He goes, I groan not that I would be naked or unclothed. I'm not trying to discard the body. It's not why I'm groaning, because my body's hurting me. I'm groaning to be further clothed, because he was talking to the Corinthians were Greeks. They had this negative view of the body. He goes, I'm not joining your team because I'm groaning about right now. They're going, see, Paul didn't like the body either. He goes, no, I do like the body. I am groaning for the other one. I'm not anti-body right now. And they were anti-physical body. That's the point. He would not back away from that. Yeah.
And the main reason Paul kept going back and forth in his vocabulary from tent to building and so on is he's
the house,
he's every time he was talking about the physical body that we currently have, he was putting it as a tent, using a temporary word. And whenever he spoke about the body that we will have, that's when he was using a permanent word, like a building, a habitation, and so on, to show the difference. And so, I mean, I would... I'd be surprised if Paul had given up going, God, would you just heal me? You know, other than
I don't think we're answering your question. I don't think I did.
Okay, I'm just going to try one more time. I believe what you're saying.
Okay.
He's groaning for
the
resurrection.
So I won't re-say all
that. I believe that. I'm saying the very presence of his pain in his body actually caused him to groan more for the healing.
Right.
So
if you're hungry and fasting, you appreciate food more.
That's more what I'm saying.
Hunger is the best sauce.
So I'm saying, is there room in our theological understanding of healing that it's not just I mean, we do pray for the person until they die. I get that. Okay. But there's actually something that, whether it's persecution or maybe someone's deformed in their body and they never get healed, but the actual experience of that deformity or whatever it is, I know I'm making a lot of people mad right now. I don't care. But I'm just asking the question. Is that very thing something that in the
makes
resurrection
them more.
Makes them grown more for a something that is so liberating that we dance even
I
harder?
I think they've grown more, just like when you fast, you appreciate food
that's,
more.
That's just what I'm wrestling with. So
yeah, I think there's truth to that. I don't know they get greater glory because they bore with sickness. I think they get greater glory because they pressed into Jesus with the obstacle of sickness, not because of the sickness, because they pressed into Jesus.
You made a statement that said you can't know the fullness without the lack, meaning you can't know the joy without the pain, you know, part. That argument would mean that Adam could never have enjoyed the fullness of God unless he did sin, and the whole point of God putting him there was so that he would sin, so that he could experience the pain and then enjoy the fullness. And I don't think that was God's original plan.
Okay, I'm going to put you on probation for 2 weeks. Here it is. Only easy questions for the next 2 weeks. No, I'm joking. He really thinks his stuff through. I actually love it, Chris, to be honest.
I'm going
to
do one online. I think it's an easy question. It's verse 29 of chapter 15, baptism for the dead. What is Paul speaking of here?
Okay, I skipped that just because of time. Paul did not endorse baptism for the dead. Baptism for the dead was because it was a custom they did. And the theory is they got it from their pagan customs. And they thought, my friend, loved one, died on their death, I mean, got born again on their deathbed. Like, we couldn't baptize them. They were dying, so they died, and so we baptized them. And Paul wasn't saying that was good. He didn't comment good or bad. He just said, why would you do that and then say there's no resurrection? He was using their own practice to say, you're denying your own logic. He wasn't affirming it, and the Bible never affirms it. And again, it was somebody who died on their, that got born again on their deathbed, and they baptized right. Just in case to make sure they were saved. And there's nothing in the Bible that would support doing that. But he was, again, pointing out their illogical way of then, why baptize them if you don't even believe in the resurrection? What's the point of that?
So it's another form of arguing for it. Good. Okay. Katie next. Katie?
Week you talked about 1 Corinthians 3:14, and then this week 2 Corinthians 5:9. Are those the same events, and when does that happen?
Yes. You mean the judgment seat. Both of them are judgment seat. Yes, okay. They are both the same. The judgment seat's mentioned three times as judgment seat. 1 Corinthians 3, the passage you just said, the 2 Corinthians 5, verse 10, and Romans chapter 14, verse 10 to 12. There's three times. And he's always talking about the same thing.
Okay. When is that?
Oh, what's that? No. The judgment seat of Christ is the evaluation of believers at the time of the second coming, when we get our garments and our position in the millennium and all that. And the great white throne would be the unbelievers at the end.
Okay. Right. And so like
got saved during the millennium.
Yeah, it's hard to know how that works. I mean, that's just such could, but there's just absence of knowledge on that.
So like on the Sea of Glass, this happens?
Who knows? We don't know.
But it's at that event when Christ comes.
Yes, because okay. The bride gets her garments at the second coming related to her deeds of righteousness. Cool. And you get your position in the millennium of reigning, the measure of the glory of God, all kinds of things related, crowns related to your obedience. So you get them at the beginning of the millennium. But I don't know if it's the first day, the first minute, the first week. I don't know how that works.
And the resurrected body is one of the rewards.
The resurrected body with a higher degree of glory and lower degree of glory is reality. Is, you know, as one star differs from another in glory, so also will our resurrected bodies be.
So it's us going, the rapture, going up to meet Christ, getting what you just said, and then
that's when we get evaluated right. In that kind of context.
Okay.
We don't exactly know how that works.
And or how long. Because if that's all got to happen, and then Jesus comes back, that happens before Jesus returns?
It's in context to him rapturing us.
Okay.
Again, how fast, when. He's got all his files are all up to date right now.
Okay.
So it's not like he's opening a new file on anybody. It's all there, and he's really smart. So it probably happens really quick.
I think you ought to figure that out.
But to tie it in, you know, on this day or that, we just can't do that. But it's at the beginning of the millennium in context. I like to say in context of the second coming. We can't quite tell when. You guys got any more to add to that? Just kind of.
I just think when we think about the judgment and whether we're thinking about believers who are being rewarded or unbelievers who, it says if their name isn't found in the Lamb's Book of Life, then they look at the books, how did they live? And they're punished based on how evil they were or not evil and so on. And I think, I mean, if you think about how many people have lived since the beginning of, you know, since Adam and Eve, and you went, oh, let's see, if it took God 10 minutes per person, you know, how long is it going to take? I don't think it works for us to process it that way and say, when is it going to be and how's it going to happen? For all we know, you know, if God can be everywhere at once, or who knows, maybe everybody suddenly thinks they're right before the throne and the rest of you aren't here and it's just me and God, you know? We have no idea. And so trying to put all that together, again, goes into speculation, and we don't need to land it. We don't have to know it.
It's just in context to the second coming. That's good enough, I think.
Abby has another question along those lines. Okay.
Yeah, so my question, it's kind of based out of last week's teaching out of Matthew 25, but also kind of along this topic as well. So you talked about Jesus judging the Gentile nations at the end of Matthew 25. And my question is, like, in relation to this, when is the white throne judgment and how is it different?
The great white throne judgment is at the end of the millennial kingdom for unbelievers.
For unbelievers.
Yes.
And so this is for believers?
Yes. Believe which one? The Matthew
25. Matthew 25.
That's at the beginning of the millennium when he's judging the unsaved survivors of the Great Tribulation.
It's particularly how they related to Israel.
Yeah. So like the unsaved survivors, because if they were saved, they would have been raptured. If they took the mark of the beast, they'd get executed. So it's
unsaved.
That third group. Survivors. There'll be hundreds of millions of them, possibly.
Okay. And then as
we don't
believers,
know the real number.
The judgment seat of when we are evaluated or
that's
judged.
In context of the rapture, which is at the time the same as the second coming. We don't know exactly how that works, but that's in context of that.
Okay. Because
so
all
I had
the judgments, it's like, when is it? Who is it for?
If I had a timeline, the rapture comes, which to me, well, I mean, which is synonymous with Jesus returning. The believers get evaluated. Judged is the right word, but evaluated is the concept. After that is the Matthew 25. Then 1,000 years later is the great white throne where everybody that's in hell gets thrown into the lake of fire. Because hell's like in the center of the earth. They're taken out of hell and cast into the lake of fire.
Okay.
I don't know if it's the center of the earth, but it's down there somewhere.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. Thank
does that
you.
Make sense? So,
I think so.
No, not I think so.
A lot of people have this question.
Okay, now let's do it again. No, meaning not that you don't have it clear. That means I didn't give it clear. So the church is evaluated at the rapture, second coming, the seventh trumpet, right?
That's the judgment seat of Christ.
Seat of Christ. We get evaluated. We don't know exactly how that works, but it's right then. It's in context of that. A little bit later, weeks, I don't know, is the Matthew 25 judgment of the unsaved survivors. We don't know how much later, but it's right after Jesus returns. 1,000 years after that is all the unbelievers.
So why is it the unsaved
survivors?
Survivors.
It's kind of a hard thing to say. Unsaved survivors.
Yeah, sorry.
Let me say it this way. Unsaved survivors of the Great Tribulation. Say it backwards, fast, 3 times.
Shodadada.
There you go. Perfect.
There we go. I got it. So, because when I, even that parable, I'm thinking, okay, how do I respond? You know what I mean?
You won't be at the Matthew 25 judgment. You'll be at the judgment seat of Christ if you're alive when the Lord comes at the time of the rapture, which is the second coming.
Okay. So we usually have these like the church preaches this to the church. You know what I mean? Like
what? The church preaches
the,
what?
The Matthew 25 of how, you know, clothe, you know, when you feed The least of these, you feed me, you know, that whole thing.
I have no doubt that is part of the evaluation when we are at the judgment seat, because Jesus doesn't change. He's the same judge. He doesn't have different rules
or different
principles, I mean.
Okay. And then, so there's like three different judgments per se. Okay.
And maybe more that we don't have fully understand.
Okay, no, that's helpful.
Those are the three, yes. Okay. But that Matthew 25, you didn't feed, undoubtedly when we stand before him, you and me, that will be in the evaluation.
Okay.
But failing the evaluation for believers doesn't result in the lake of fire.
Yeah, loss of reward. Good point, Steve.
Which is what Matthew 25 does. When you fail that judgment, those people will end up in the lake of fire.
Good point. Unsafe survivors.
Unsafe survivors
of the Great Tribulation.
Good, thank you.
Good question. I think we have more along this line.
So, yeah, it's related to that. They're going to the lake of fire, which is the eternal judgment.
Yes.
So in essence, human beings go to the lake of fire before the devil and his angels go to the lake of fire.
I don't think so. Says they will. It doesn't say they are at that time
so
going.
So they're not going to the lake of
fire. The only one thrown in the lake of fire at the beginning of the tribulation of the millennium is the false prophet and the Antichrist. Satan is locked in prison, not in the lake of fire. They're thrown in the lake of fire after the millennium. I don't know why those two go ahead of time. I don't get why that works.
I think it's Psalm 110. You know, the nations are brought before Jesus, and he executes the heads of many nations. Uh-huh. And so there's probably going to be some that are less than they. I mean, if he's executing the heads of many nations, this judgment, those who do not go as sheep into the kingdom will be executed at that time, raised again at the second judgment, and judged at that time and thrown in.
But I like the way Stuart taught it years ago.
Would they go over the 1,000 years?
Would they go over the 1,000 years?
Yeah. Wait.
So basically,
once
you
get judged, they go to the lake of fire. He says, depart from me to the eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels, right? 41.
Yeah, I think Stuart said it so good.
Okay.
Hell is down in the earth, which is burning fire. And it's the same fire that the lake of fire, because hell's thrown into the lake of fire.
Right.
Okay, so people, unbelievers, go to hell with a disembodied spirit. Their spirit is in hell, which is fire. And the lake, and that's called hell. And at the end of the millennium, hell is thrown into the lake of fire. So the way Stuart said it, I liked it. He called it the local jail in the federal prison. That hell is the local jail, and the lake of fire is the federal prison. Like, there's a lot of folks that are going to jail, they go to the local one for a while till they get tried, then they go to the federal one. I thought that was a good analogy.
Okay.
And the only two thrown into the lake of fire before the millennium are the false prophet and the Antichrist, according to the scripture. We don't know if anybody else is. They're the only two designated. Yeah.
But to get to the lake of fire, you need a body.
Yeah.
So in hell, you're in disembodied spirit.
Right, that's right.
At the second resurrection,
right,
the unsaved dead are
get
a physical body, and transferred to the lake of fire.
Right, right.
So these that are killed at the judgment of Matthew 25 are in hell, but their body is dead.
It's
just
the
like
same
Psalm
fire.
110.
It's the same eternal fire. That's why you can call it eternal fire.
But ultimately,
you do have
they
in number six, though, that Korah goes into hell alive.
He would have gone into hell.
Why
don't
you and Chris go have a coffee and just talk? You guys go. Kirk will pay for it, okay? Kirk will buy you coffee.
Here comes
We're just simple Bible guys up here, you know?
So I have a comments and a question. So I was translating you, Mike, tonight into Korean.
This is our Korean Berean, just so you know it. For real, he is.
And you talk really fast. So.
And I was trying, I tried like
I know you had a lot of materials.
I slowed down 5 or 6 times. I did on purpose.
Yeah,
I just
very
didn't
good. Thank
stay
you.
With it for more than 60 seconds.
And actually, I think a lot of us feel the same way. But having studied the last 2 years of Old Testament, and then you especially emphasized the pastoral exhortation part, last week with Matthew 25 and this week, really, really encouraging and giving us a lot of confidence. But my question is on Matthew 25. So I was studying this pretty extensively, and I'm pretty convinced that this is what you are teaching and a lot of other teachers are teaching. But My question was on
the 10 virgins.
Right. The Matthew 25, 31 through 46, the goat nations and the sheep nations. But the question I had that I still have to not have the total clarity is that there has to be something in that unique dynamic at the time after Christ returns, beginning of the millennium.
Right.
And so I was looking at the Isaiah 49, verse 22,
right,
where Jesus says, I'll raise up a standard in the context of almost making a decree for the nations to help him bring the
right.
captive
bring the Jews
back
to Jerusalem. Yeah, right.
And then Isaiah 11, 12 talks about right. the same thing. So that's my comment and question. Am I on the right track?
Yes, I think those two, in part, that right, happened right, from 48 right. on, but in fullness, that happens at the second coming.
Right. So the question I am asking you is that, do you have any other scripture verses that would help the complete the story of the unique dynamic and context why Jesus makes it so important for the nations to support and help the Jews return, and why is that important to him? And one of the hints that I get is actually in Isaiah 49, verse 5 and 6, where fathers talk about Jesus' assignment. He says, I have raised you up to bring the nation of Israel back. And that not only that you are going to regather the nation of Israel, but you'll be the light to all the Gentiles.
Yeah, it's too small of a thing.
Right,
only
right,
Israel,
right.
That's what he said, yeah.
But my question to you is, do you have any other verses that would make that more clear and supportive of why that is so important, the nations will stand with Israel at that time in history?
In just one sentence, because that's a big subject, right, right. and I'd rather put all that on Samuel Cloud to answer. But he knows that Whitfield... To answer that, he's really good at that. But I think at the end of the day, it's the historical miracle of the Jews and the Gentiles, the Arabs and the Jews being unified. The John 17 verse, unified like I and the Father, we think about the Methodists and the Baptists getting unified, and that's good. I like that. But it's true, but it's the ultimate is the Arabs and the Jews in profound unity, and God setting it up, and this is all part of that, so his family is all in mercy in unity forever with physical bodies. That to me is the ultimate of what he's after. But there's lots of other little sub thoughts.
Good. Okay, a couple online questions. Now we're going back to Matthew 24. So hold on. Actually, we'll do Matthew 25 first. So this is the question. We've answered it in part, which is when is the timing of the judgment in Matthew 25, 31 through 46, and why? Because it seems to me that it takes place after all Jesus' brethren return during the new millennium. Please elaborate. Thank you for your patience.
So their point is they're asking, is it the beginning of the millennium or after it? Is that the point?
The point is at what point, I think, once the millennium sets
at
up. At
the beginning-ish. We don't know if it's week one, week two, week three, but it's at the beginning, not at the end.
And when do we hear, they said all Jesus' brethren, so when do we know? Do we know when all the Jews are recollected? At what point?
I think it takes some weeks and months.
Yeah. Jesus will know.
And maybe longer than weeks and months from the whole world. But I mean, it's a real recovery. It might be a year or two because all the transportation systems are broken. So it's not easy to get them from New Zealand back to Jerusalem. It's not easy.
When the sea's been turned to blood.
No, really. It's going to take a while to get systems in place. So it could be weeks or months, or maybe the Eden conditions heal them real quick.
Right.
Okay. I think this goes back to
it's hard to say.
Trying to take too many details, make too many details fit. And how exactly is God going to make it all happen? And we don't need to know those details. I look at it and I go, why would I need to know that? Is that part of the forerunner message? Is that something I need to know or somebody else needs to know in order to make it through the tribulation? And if they don't need to, then we don't need to.
Okay.
I'll take it.
All right, so can we go to Matthew 24?
I saw you waiting on her questions. It's been a long day today.
Yes.
Oh, it feels good. We're almost there. Okay.
Thanks. So... One for 24, chapter 24. I guess we are going in. Okay, here we go. I was wondering if you consider the beginning of the birth pains to be entirely separate from, overlap, or be the seals themselves, i.e. in Matthew 24 when Jesus talks about wars, rumors of wars. Do you believe...
I would say they're overlapped. They are distinct, but they overlap. I mean, they're happening before the seals, but they're very similar to the seals. The seals are just more intense.
Okay, good. All right, we have one final one, then I'll go to Hiram here. This is a question that I've heard several times. Someone's asking again online. How can we know the day question when we already know that believers, we already know that the tribulation is 3.5 years of tribulation when it begins? So how do we reconcile in Matthew 24, you can't know the day when in, we know the Great Tribulation lasts for exactly 3.5 years?
It seems or 1,260 days.
1,260 days
is even more specific.
Even more specific.
Yes. I think, so the question is, Jesus says you can't know the day or the hour. And I heard Alan teach it one time. I thought it was so interesting. He said, no one knows the day or the hour. Then Alan went on ahead and said, but it didn't say no one will ever not know the day or the hour. I thought, I never thought about that. But so that might be true. But another thing that might be true is the abomination of desolation, just like the Lord's way, may have 3 or 4 debatable beginning points. Like when he went in and put the image, when he started the image on the worldwide system, when there might be 2 to 3 days where it's not sure which is the day. I don't know. It could. The Lord's always playing 10-dimensional chess. So I'm thinking it might not be as precise as we think. That day, there might be 3 to 4 days that people debate is that day.
Got it. Good. Thank you.
Yes, of course.
I just connected the, well, before, and Jesus said in Matthew 24, as in the days of Noah. And Noah didn't know the day of the hour, but twice, 7 days before the flood, the Lord says, it's in 7 days. He did twice in Genesis 6.
You got the verses?
I can read it in Spanish if you
Well,
want.
That's okay. I mean, but for the others, do it in English, but give it to me.
Yeah, I'll give it to you. But it's right there. I will give you the verses in a second, but it's twice.
I'd like it.
So it's kind of like the same thing.
Did you give the verse to Cindy as well?
It's Genesis 7:4.
Hey, Cindy, so Genesis 7:4.
Genesis 7:4. For after 7 more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth for 40
that.
Days and 40 nights.
Okay.
So
that's one. And there's one more, but that's good enough. Yeah.
7 days, there's 7 years.
There's also in 1 Thessalonians 5, where Paul uses the same language, saying the whole, while they're saying peace and safety, sudden destruction, verse 4, but you, brethren, are not in darkness that the day would overtake you like a thief. So he's saying
The day
would not overtake you like a thief. He says, at the first verse, now as to the times and epochs, brethren, you have no need of anyone to be written of you, for yourselves know well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. Then verse 4, but you, brethren, are not in darkness that the day would overtake you like a thief. So it's saying that generation that's walking in the light will know the day.
Yeah, it's because, like again, Alan said, no one knows the day, but Jesus didn't say, nobody. It's not true that no one will never know the day, or however you say that, it's a double negative.
Yeah, I don't think Jesus is like the CIA. I'd tell you, but I'd have to kill you.
Thank you. Good word.
Good. We'll end on that one.
Two more questions. Then we're going to end with these two. Okay.
I used to believe once saved, always saved, until David Pawson came at your invitation.
Oh boy.
Years ago, and taught an amazing teaching on it, and suddenly I realized that the New Testament was full of texts that addressed that issue. One of them being the unprofitable servant being cast into outer darkness. He was a servant at one point, but you didn't comment on it or anything, so I was just curious.
I was dodging it. No. He said, not then, but you are now. No, I believe a person can lose their salvation. I used to not believe it. I do believe it. I think it's hard to do it. I don't think you can do it twice. I think that you commit the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. You can't undo that, but you don't want to undo it. So anybody who's done it doesn't care that they've done it. So it's not like you have a bad 3 years. I think they lost it. Ooh, they got it back. Ooh, I think they lost it. I think you're going to lose it once. But I don't want to get into that doctrine at this hour right now. Yeah.
Okay. So the comments you made a couple comments about, but I'm not talking about losing their salvation. Tonight you made that comment, but you do believe there is a category.
Yeah, I think, I think there's going to be a great falling away of truly born-again believers. But again, I think you only lose it once. Not because he wears out, because you get so hardened, you never want it back. You have to get that hardened to lose it. So you don't lose it like because you just had a bad month. You lose it because you're fiercely determined that you don't want it.
Okay, this is our last question for the evening. That's terrifying, what you just said. That's terrifying.
Yeah, I met a woman once who I think lost her salvation. It was a terrifying experience to me.
Yeah. So my question is, does how you get saved change? Because in the Old Testament, it was by faith, but it wasn't faith in Jesus necessarily. It's faith in following the word that God told you to do. And I think that when Jesus went down to hell and whatnot, that he preached to the saints who were in their holding place or whatever, and they came up with him. But then after we get raptured in Matthew 25:46, says these unbelieving people will go away into eternal punishment, but those who are righteous and in right standing with God, which you find out over here, that's just because they helped the Jewish people. Not that they accepted Jesus, they just helped the Jewish people.
No, but they have to accept Jesus, though, yeah. They're only helping the Jewish people because they honor Jesus. I wouldn't say only, but that's the main reason.
This is before he comes down, though, right? So he comes down and then judges all of them, saying, because you did this here.
Nobody gets saved because they help Jewish people, and that's it. You get saved only one way, through relationship with Jesus, yeah.
I was just curious because we never stated that. I was like, it's not really clear in here. So, but yeah, it just says to get eternal salvation. I was like, just for feeding Jewish people? I don't know. It was interesting to me. So you say they get saved.
Because of Jesus.
Okay.
And that's the evidence of it. Like our good works are evidence that we're obeying his leadership, not the earning of our salvation.
And you got to remember, these good works toward the Jewish people are in the midst of an atmosphere of the Antichrist.
Right.
Which means that if you go against the Antichrist, you're believing in Jesus Christ and you're following what he says instead of what the guy who's right in front of your face says, do it or I'll kill you.
And you supported the Jews and the Nazi regime. It was very definitive reason.
Right. But you said there's the unsaved survivors. There's us who get raptured, and then there's the Antichrist army and the people who got that mark. So the people who are surviving would be not the army, but the goats, whoever the goats are, the sheep, who are those who love the Jewish people. But the saved ones are already raptured up.
Right.
So that is end up leaving during that period of time.
Right.
And never states that. Okay, cool. Just making sure.
Many of the unsaved survivors will get saved. I mean, I think the majority will. I can't say the number, but I think it will be the majority of the earth that's unsaved survivors will be saved. Right. Not in 1 minute, but they'll get saved.
Right. It just wasn't specifically mentioned in that part, so I was like, just making sure. Okay.
Okay, this concludes the Q&A for tonight. Bless you. Thank you, panelists. Great questions. Have a great night.